So we're kind of in the middle of things. So again, for people who just joined us, I apologize. But, we're in the section of the Haggadah, which now deals with the ten Makos. Now this is already a new section. Now, how did we get there? We got there with the very last drasha that Chazal had on the last pasuk of the Bikurim parsha. Because the last pasuk says, right, Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim with Yad Chazakah, a strong hand, Zeroah Netuyah, an outstretched arm, Myra Gadol, great fearsomeness, Osos, signs, and Mofsim, oneness. And according to the Dover Acher, this is the second drasha. Chazal look at the fact that Yad Chazakah are two words, therefore they represent two plagues. Zeroah and Netuyah are two words representing two plagues. Mora Gadol are two words representing two plagues. That gives you six. Osos is a plural word giving you two. And Mofsim is a plural word giving you two. And hence the idea of the ten Makos is Merumas in the Pasuk. So once we have that, at that point, Chazal enumerate the ten Makos. And it indicates that Rabbi Yehuda took the ten Makos and he made it into three groups of three, and four. Could you close the door? Yeah, three, and four, and we'll discuss the significance of those abbreviations. Now, once we get to the ten Makos, there is it's really Ein Lahem Sof. I mean, one could easily spend a year talking about the ten Makos and the patterns of the ten Makos. If you look at the Maharal Sefer Gevuros Hashem, he really goes on and on and on and on in every dividing the Makos in every conceivable way. Shamayim, Eretz, in between, person, animal. You know, there are many, many different ways of dividing up the Makos. And the Maharal goes through all of these different ways of dividing up the Makos. But the one point that I do want to make very, very clear is that we have to understand the purpose of the Makos generally. The superficial answer would be the Makos were the mechanism that forced Paro to let the Jewish people go, and therefore it was the way that the Jewish people left Mitzrayim. But that superficial answer is behechrich, not a sensical answer, in a sense, because there's a lot easier ways for Hashem to take us out of Mitzrayim. I mean, the Makos took place over a whole year. If Hashem wanted to take us out of Mitzrayim, and if the only goal was to beat up Paro until he let us go, Hashem could have just taken us out, right? He could have destroyed Mitzrayim in a second, or he didn't have to destroy Mitzrayim. He just could have lifted us out. Moreover, since we do read that Hashem hardened Paro's heart, and we'll discuss what that would mean, then in a sense the whole thing is counterproductive, because Hashem is acting against his own purposes. I'm giving you the Makos to force you to let the Jewish people go, but when you're ready to let them go, I'm not going to let you let them go. So obviously, from the very context of Hashem hardening Paro's heart, and I'll discuss, you know, why that was so and what that means, but without even before knowing why it was done, you can't say the Makos are designed to force Paro to let us go if Hashem is not going to let Paro let us go in spite of those Makos. So because of this, one has to understand that the ultimate tachlis of the Makos were not to secure the freedom of the Jewish people. In fact, Hashem didn't want it to happen too quickly, because Hashem wanted to play out all of these Makos, but rather to demonstrate his absolute rule over the universe, over all of the natural forces of the universe, that all of the laws of nature are nothing more than extensions of what Hashem's will is at any given moment in time. And as a result, Hashem can change gravity and chemical composition and, you know, change any law of nature. And this was absolutely essential. It was essential, number one, that the Egyptians, the Goyim, needed to know. But most importantly, it was a lesson for Bnei Yisrael. Because remember, we are being taken out of Mitzrayim, leaving the Avdus of Para to become the Avdei Hashem. But at the same time, we have to understand that Hashem is not just another Para. This is a qualitatively different relationship. that we need to understand what it means to be an Eved Hashem. And in order to understand what it means to be an Eved Hashem, you have to understand what Hashem is. The Kol Yachol, the infinite power, the omnipotent force of which every single thing in the universe is created by and is subject to. So the Makos were not just to get us out of Mitzrayim. The Makos were to demonstrate Hashem's power, and that is why, even if Paro wanted to let us out early, we're going to see there was this hardening of Paro's heart. And again, if you look in the Chumash itself, you will see over and over again, many times during the Makos, Hashem says, I am bringing these Makos so that my name will be known throughout the world, so that my glory and that my power will be understood. And not only for Mitzrayim, but Laman Tesaper, Biazne Bincha Ben Bincha. Hashem says to Bnei Yisrael, so you shall recount to your children and to your grandchildren, Eis Asher Hisalalti B'Mitzrayim, that which I mocked the Egyptians. They were like marionettes, they were like puppets, that when they wanted to do something, they couldn't do it. Right? And V'yadatem, so you shall know, Ki Ani Hashem. Right, so that's a very, very important yisoy to understand the concept of the ten makos. Now, there's an interesting thought from the Chiddush Yerim, and this would take time to correlate, so I'm not going to give you a whole correlation, but just to give you the thoughts. We know that the world was created, Pirkei Avos tells us, Biasora Mamaros Nivra Ha'olam. The world was created with 10 statements. In the beginning, Hashem created, that statement number one, and then Vayomer Hashem, Hashem said, Hashem said, Hashem said. So there is a medrash that says the 10 makos correspond to the 10 ma'amoros shenivra ha'olam. This is the medrash. So the Chiddushi HaRim explains it this way. He explains it that the Arizal, and Sefer Chassidus take this on, say that the Asara Ma'amaros, which we look at creation, are actually progressive levels of concealment, meaning to say the creative process of the world proceeds from pure spirituality till it gradually gets more and more physicalized, more and more materialized, so the spark of godliness that is in the Bria gets covered up and covered up and covered up. It's still there, but by the time it becomes a table, a chair, or even a person, the godly spark is much, much harder to detect. So creation is actually the progressive concealment of divinity as the world becomes more and more spiritual. Again, without getting into the technical vocabulary of Kabbalah. Kabbalah, of course, describes four worlds, Atzilus, emanation, Bria, creation, Yitzira, formation, and this world is the world of Asiya. So this is abbreviated Avya, Aleph, Beis, Yud, Ayin. And Atzilus is a world of pure Ruchnis, that is the closest to Hashem. And then as it descends into progressively more physical layers, so still Bria, Yetzira, the godliness does not depart. It's not less godliness, but it's more covered up godliness until it reaches Asiya, in which it's very hard to see Hashem in the world as we have it. So the Asara Ma'amoros, and the way it works is, within every one of the four worlds, there are Asara Ma'amoros. So you have the Asara Ma'amoros of Atzilus, and then the Asara Ma'amaros of Bria, and the Asara Ma'amaros of Yetzira, and the Asara Ma'amaros of Asiya. So even within Atzilus, there is a progressive concealment of the divine light. But of course, any level of Atzilus is much higher than the highest level of Bria. In fact, some Svarim say that this is why you find that the number 40 is always connected to creation, because the total number of ma'amaros that Hashem had for all four worlds was 40, 10 for each world. That is why we say a vlad, a fetus, is not, or an embryo, is not considered to be alive until it is 40 days old. That is why a mikveh, which represents new birth, new creation, whether it's a woman being reunited with her husband, whether it's a non-Jew becoming a Jew. So we're not going to tell you stay in the mikveh for 40 days, that would be a little difficult, but we talk about 40 saw. That is why Matan Torah was 40 days, because this was the creation of the Jewish people. Right? 40 is connected to creation, because Asara Mamoros in each of the four worlds. So some want to say, this is why Melechus Shabbos is only 39 Melechus, not 40. Because of the 40 Mamoros that Hashem had, we can do 39 things. But the idea of creating something from absolutely nothing, the Yesh Me'ayin, that we can't do. So human beings only have a Shaychus to 39 of the 40 Ma'amaras. But be this as it may, the Chiddush Yerim says that the Ma'amaras are progressive concealments of Hashem. So the first Ma'amar conceals Hashem a little bit. He or, because light is the most ethereal, most spiritual. As you keep on going more and more and more, it covers up the Gamri. So the Chiddush Yerim says that the 10 Makos, each maka strips away one of the curtains of the 10 mamaras. So what he says is the following. The first maka takes away the 10th curtain. The second maka takes away the 9th curtain. The third maka takes away the 8th curtain. And makas bechoros takes away the final curtain. And Hashem is revealed in His totality in the universe. And what the Chiddush Yerim tries to do is, although we have it only b'kitzur, so we don't have the full working out of it, he wants to show how each makah corresponds to that particular mimer. Now, in one case, it's very blatant, very obvious, because the second mimer is "Let there be light." He or. And the 9th maka is darkness. So there you see it was exactly the opposite. So you could try this. Make a list of the makos and the mamoros and see if you can, in reverse order, and see if you can match up a correspondence between the maka and the maimer. Now, although this thought itself is intricate, but the basic idea that the makos are taking away, people like to compare it, although it's really almost the opposite idea. People compare it to the Wizard of Oz, Lahavdil, when Dorothy, I'm sure you all have seen the Wizard of Oz. Actually, if you're not American, I don't know, but at least the Americans have all seen the Wizard of Oz. The Wizard of Oz, finally the curtain is pulled away. But of course, it's totally the opposite there. There the curtain is pulled away and you see that he's nobody. He's just doing tricks. But here, the curtain is pulled away. And you see the Melech Melchei HaMelechim in all of his grandeur, in all of his glory, in all of his infinite power. Right? So that's what the Makos are all about. Now, one of the big questions that the Rambam himself addresses in Hilchos Tshuva is this problem of Hashem hardening Paro's heart. Because the Rambam lays down a very fundamental rule that everybody knows, that it is fundamental to the Torah that human beings have free will to do good or not do good. Each person, the Rambam says, can be a tzaddik, as great as Moshe Rabbeinu, or a rasha, as evil as Yeravam ben Nevat, the first king of Israel who built golden calves that people worshipped. And Hashem does not decree. Hashem may decree if you're rich or you're poor, you're smart or you're not smart, sick or healthy. But Hashem does not decree if a person will be a tzaddik or a rasha. This is what Chazal say, Hakol bidei shamayim. Everything is in the hands of heaven. Chutz mi yireh shamayim. Right? This is essential. And the Rambam proves his point from logic. And he says, if a person were predetermined to be a tzaddik or a rasha, then how could Hashem reward him for his good actions? You don't reward a computer because it worked today. And how could I be punished for something beyond my control? That would be unjust. And since Hashem is not unjust, it's absolutely clear that I could be responsible only for that which I have the capacity of choosing. Moreover, the Rambam says, if you don't believe in Bechira, tshuva becomes impossible. How can you do tshuva? You're just going to be the same, you know, as you always were. Not only that, see, it's 2 points about tshuva. One is, how could I do tshuva if I don't have Bechira? And the second point is, why should I have to do tshuva if I don't have Bechira? See, it's both. There's both a why problem and a how problem there. So the Rambam says, Bechira, that's a given. Now that itself is quite complicated. Rav Dessler has a big essay because he makes the point, he introduces a very fundamental idea. Everybody has Bechira. Everybody has Bechira. But the focal point of your Bechira may change from person to person and from situation to situation. So for example, a person that's a Shomer Mitzvahs, so I've already committed myself, I keep Shabbos, I keep kosher, I wear tefillin. So when I come to morning Seder, I have to make a choice. Should I learn well for 4 hours or should I bottle? Or only learn for 2 hours? Yeah. And Hashem is going to hold me accountable. Why did I only learn for 1 hour or not learn at all? I could have done better. Now, take the heroin addict in the street. When he goes out to Shemayim after 120 years, well, probably won't be 120 years because heroin, but whenever he goes out to Shemayim, is Hashem going to say, I see that on that day you were in the middle of a heroin addiction, why didn't you come to morning Seder that day? You know, Rav Dessler says, obviously, people at certain points in their life, Hashem does not expect them to be up here. But he has the choice that he could have gone into a drug rehab center. So Rav Dessler's point is, when the Rambam says everybody has free will, it doesn't mean everybody has free will to make the same choice at any moment in time, but there is what is called a nekudas habechira. There is a fulcrum point. And that fulcrum point will change as you grow in your avodah Hashem. In fact, this is true for both good and bad. For example, there may be good things that most of us are not struggling with anymore. So for example, somebody who's been from a long time, he doesn't walk by a McDonald's and, you know, Trafe McDonald's, I'm not going to posture on McDonald's here, that's already, but he's not going to walk by a Trafe restaurant and say, oy vey, I have to choose not to go there. So Hashem is not going to reward you for making that choice because that's not in your conflict zone anymore. But there'll be other things, not speaking Lashon Hara, etc. In other words, every person will have a different point of conflict. So Bechira is fundamental to Yiddishkeit, but people's Bechira struggle will be different for each person and different in different stages of your life. Okay. But after the Rambam introduces Bechira, the Rambam then raises two questions. And it's important to know these are two different questions. Do not confuse them, because the answers are different. But both of them are questions about the Exodus. Question number one is, if Hashem cannot punish people unless they had free will, then why are the Egyptians punished at all, since Hashem decreed, when he told Avram, your children will be enslaved in a land that is not theirs? Hashem decreed that the Jewish people will be slaves. Now again, be sure you, this is not asking Hashem harden Paro's heart. That's another question. Because you'll see that the Rambam's answer does not answer that question. So the question is, if Hashem decreed that we're slaves, how could the Mitzrayim be punished at all? So on that, the Rambam's answer is, number one, Hashem didn't decree that the Egyptians would enslave them. The Chumash just says, Eretz lo lahem, a land that is not theirs. And Hashem certainly didn't decree that any individual Egyptian would have to be an enslaved. Hashem didn't say, hey, you George, I decree you will beat a Jew. So it is true that Hashem decreed that the Jewish people would suffer punishment and suffering. But each individual Egyptian had the free will to do it or not do it. Again, it's the same issue with the Holocaust. You know, if Hashem didn't want 6 million Jews to die, then they wouldn't have died. The answer is, Hashem had such bonus, which we don't understand. Hashem decreed, again, we don't understand, but Hashem decreed this would happen. But Hashem didn't decree any individual Nazi would pull the trigger. And therefore, Rishayim are responsible for their choices, even though, in a sense, everything that happens was decreed by God. But the Rasha had free choice not to do it. Right? I mean, this question is fundamental. I mean, this explains, you know, this is how we approach the Crusades, the pogroms, the Holocaust, terrorism. Meaning, just because on some level it was God's will, and again, I'm not giving you a reason why, it was God's will that these things will happen, the tochecha, whatever it is, that does not let the bad guy off the hook. The bad guy had bechira. Okay, that's the answer to the first question. But then the Rambam asks a second question. And the second question is, well, that might explain why the Egyptians get punished, because nobody was forcing them to make particular decisions. But at some point, it says Hashem hardened Paro's heart, which means that even if Paro would have wanted to let the Jewish people go free, Hashem somehow did not allow him to make that decision. So there you can't give the answer, oh, the bad guy had the autonomy. Hashem took away Paro's autonomy, right? This is a separate question, right? Be sure it's not the same as the first question. The first question was based on the Bris Bein Absarim. The second question is based on Vayaksha Hashem, a slave Pare. So here, yeah.
Can you say something about the Nazis? Because we don't know where it was the day that Hashem declared. What are you saying? In that case, we had words.
Well, the Pashas is, again, I mean, I'm not going to, you know, certainly it would be a very, very foolish for me to say exactly what the Holocaust represented, but some Gedolim have said, or Meir Simcha, writing many years before the Holocaust, said that the types of destruction that we saw was a fulfillment of the Tochecha, in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu says that when the Jewish people wander away from God, God is going to show them that when they seek refuge with the nations of the world, they will be destroyed. Now again, it's very important to understand this. This is not explaining individual people, because it's the other way around. Many of the people who died in the Holocaust were the greatest tzaddikim and kedoshim. Remember, the tochecha is not explaining why individual people suffer. It is explaining the historical existence of the Jewish nation, and why things happen to the nation of Israel. See, you do have to differentiate this. The Ramban writes, with respect to why something happens to an individual person, that is the mystery of tzaddik v'ra'lo. Why do tzaddikim suffer? And Moshe Rabbeinu asks Hashem for the explanation, and Hashem says, I'm not telling you, and the book of Eov basically says, right, so one has to differentiate it. So that's why we're not blaming the victims. Sometimes people say, oh, you're blaming the victims. No. The victims, many of them were much, much greater than many of the people who survived. The victims were some of the greatest kedoshim that we have. But we do understand that in the historical destiny of Am Yisrael, there is a tremendous midas hadin that comes. And again, if you look at the tochecha, particularly in Sefer Devarim, and match it up with the Holocaust, it is a very, very scary and striking and staggering comparison. Yeah.
Can I say this fits with what you said yesterday, that Yaakov Avinu was also forced to come down to Mitzrayim?
Yeah.
This wasn't a decision that he made in order to make this happen.
Right, right. Yeah, but that I think is a little different. It's a little different. He was forced in the sense that he didn't want to do it, but he chose to obey God. And in other words, see, the word force is used in two different ways. I mean, you could say, in a sense, I'm forced to keep Shabbos. Well, it depends what you mean. I'm forced because Hashem commanded me. But if I were to stop keeping Shabbos, Hashem would not force me. With Paro, it's very different. Hashem hardened Paro's heart. That means Paro couldn't go there. You see? So on that, here's what the Rambam answer, right? So the kasha is Hashem hardened Paro's heart, right? Aye, you're punishing Paro for things he couldn't choose? That's not just. So here, the Rambam gives an idea, and it's interesting. The Rambam first wrote this idea in the Shmona Perakim, which is his Hakdama to Pirkei Avos, which he wrote much younger. He then incorporates it in Hilchos Tshuva. But in the Shmona Perakim, not only does he give the explanation, but he has a certain amount of pride in it. He was very fond of this explanation. He even says, you know, if you hear my explanation and read what anyone else says, I think you will know, you know, which is the better explanation. He says, I'll leave it to you. But okay. So he was particularly fond of this explanation. And by the time he wrote the Mishnah Torah, he kept out the personal remarks. But here's what he says. He says, you know, that when a person does averus, he'll be punished for those averus. Sometimes the punishment is in Olam Hazeh. Oftentimes it's in Olam Haba. You're not always punished in this world for averus. In fact, often Rishayim are not punished in this world. Sometimes a punishment can be death. Sometimes a punishment can be illness. And sometimes a punishment can be a loss of faculty, such as a loss of arm, a loss of sight. That could be a punishment. Now, the Rambam then says, why some Rasha is punished in Olam Haba, and some Rasha is punished by death, and some Rasha is punished by a loss of arm, and some Rasha is punished by a loss of eye? The Rambam says, I'm not going to be able to tell you that. But we do understand that Hashem has many different types of punishments, and Hashem's justice is perfect, and the person gets the punishment they're supposed to get. Okay, that's relatively straightforward. The Rambam then says, once we understand that punishment for sin can, not always will, but can involve an impairment of faculty, like loss of arm, then free will is also a faculty within man. So it may very well be that the punishment for sin, which you initially did as a matter of free will, might be you will lose your free will, so you will not be able to do tshuva to get out of your need to be punished for the other averos that you did, which were a product of your free will. So, here's what the Rambam says. The phrase, Hashem hardened Paro's heart, only appears in the second group of five makos. The first five makos, it says, Paro hardened his heart. So the Rambam says, Paro defies Hashem over and over and over and over and over again. Hashem says, this man and these people are deserving of very, very great punishments. But the problem is, Hashem says, perhaps as a result of these makos, they will do tshuva, and then I won't be able to punish them for all the averus they did. So their punishment is, the Rambam says, I will withhold from them the free will that would enable them to do tshuva. So the punishment they're getting... So, the Rambam writes, if Paro is punished because he refuses to let the Jewish people go in Makkah 6, 7, 8, and 9, he's not getting punished for 6, 7, 8, and 9. He's getting punished for 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. But Hashem hardened Paro's heart in order that he shouldn't do tshuva and get out of the punishment that is Magia Lo. Now this is very, very fascinating. Now the Rambam then says, well, if the cumulative makos are punishment for the first five, then why didn't Hashem just give him 6, 7, 8, 9 all at once? So the Rambam says Hashem had a secondary purpose. Hashem wanted to stretch it out so that people would know that Paro is a marionette in Hashem's hands. And it looks like, you know, you see the mockery of human endeavor, that even if he wants to let them go, we don't even know exactly how this works. Like, I want to let them go, but I just can't. It's hard to know operationally how that worked. But Paro just couldn't make that step, even though he really wanted to. Okay, so this is what the Rambam says, and this is how he understands Hashem hardened Paro's heart. Now, the Maral actually gives a simpler answer. Maral, yeah?
It doesn't say that on every Maka.
Say again?
It seems like some Maka Hashem didn't want Paro's heart, and others didn't.
No, in the first Makos, it says Paro, Paro heart.
In the last five, there are also Makos that are...
It doesn't say everyone.
Right.
In the last five, it's not everyone, but for some of them. So for those, he had free will, according to the Rambam. The Rambam differentiates between the two verses, when it says Hashem hardened versus Paro hardened. Now, the Maral gives a simpler explanation, although I think there may be some problems with the lesson of the Psukim. The Maral says, the whole Kasha is not a Kasha. You're asking a Kasha, if Hashem hardened Paro's heart, where was his free will, and how could he be punished if he didn't have free will? Says the Maral, it's really the opposite. Because, in a way, when you're being bombarded with supernatural plagues, that destroys your free will. You're going to give in no matter what. Hashem wanted Paro to have unfettered choice. So Hashem hardening Paro's heart meant he made Paro resistant to external pressure so that Paro would decide on his own. You see, normally Hashem doesn't do that to us because it's part of Hashem's chesed that he allows us to be influenced. For example, the Torah says the Jewish people will do tshuva from gullus and suffering. That's not the highest tshuva, but Hashem will give us external prods. He didn't want to give Paro the rachamim of an external prod. So the Maral says, hardening Paro's heart simply means pressure doesn't affect him. He's on his own. So the Maral says, free will. Paro was the freest person in history. Paro could decide to do whatever he wanted. In other words, Hashem made him like emotionally blocked. The Makos didn't affect him. And he's just asking himself, what is the right thing to do here? I mean, he sees the country being destroyed, etc. And he still decides, I'd rather enslave the Jews. So the Maral says, this wasn't an override of free will. This was an enhancement of free will. This is how the Maral understands Hashem hardening Paro's heart. Okay, but be it as it may, all of this shows you, again, going back to the first point, that the Makos are not to get the Jews out of Egypt. It makes no sense for Hashem to say, I'm giving Makos to get the Jews out of Egypt, and then I'm not going to let Paro let them go until I finish... Thank you. Till I finish all of those Makos. Okay. So as I say, there's a tremendous amount we could say in all the Makos. I just wanted to get these basic Yesodos down. Now, the Makos, according to the Mishnah in Maseches Idyos, took place over a year. Now, it's not so pashut what that means. Like everything else, there are many, many Machloksim. Some say it's not really a year, rather... from the time that Moshe first appeared to Paro till the Jews left Egypt was a year. But the Makos did not start till around 3 or 4 months later, if you make a cheshbon. So according to that, the Makos were only 8 months. Right? So there are many, many different shitas. Chazal have a statement again. Mishpat HaMitzriyim Yud Beis Chodesh, the judgment against the Egyptians was a 12-month judgment, but as they say, are you starting from Makas Dam, or are you starting from Moshe Rabbeinu's first appearance to Paro? Many, many different shitos. But the one thing that all shitos agree upon, I mentioned this yesterday, was there was a considerable amount of time between each plague. The way Rashi understands it, each plague was only a week, and you had 3 weeks between the plague, and that's why the Nitziv says that that was supplemented by the political chieftains dying, etc., so they shouldn't be able to do things in between. Okay. Now, we then come to Rabbi Yehuda, who gave the Makos a simon, meaning an abbreviation, right? That you should remember them as a mnemonic. If you can't remember, although I've always had problems with these memory things, sometimes it seems it's easier to remember the thing than to remember the mnemonic for the thing. I don't know. And maybe it depends how some people's mind works. But some people like to memorize a whole nonsense sentence. Yeah, I know, in medical school they do it all the time with the 20 rules for some neurological thing. They have these sentences and the like. But he has Datsach, Adash, Bachav, right? So Datsach, Dam, Sephardeya, Kinim, blood, frogs, lice, Adash, Oro, are wild animals coming in. Dever is animal plague, animals died like the cattle. Shechin are boils. And the last group is four, Ba'achav, Barad, the hail, Arbe, the locust, Choshech, the darkness, and the bays is Bechoros, Makas Bechoros. So the question is, what exactly is the point of the mnemonic? So here, once again, the Mefarshim give you gazillions of interpretations, many, many, many different pshatim of what is his point. According to some, his point is he wants you to remember the order. And the reason why this is important is there is a capital Tehillim, Tehillim Kufhei, 105, which is actually, some actually say it might be the original version of the Haggadah from David HaMelech's time, because Tehillim Kufhei is a recounting of Yetzias Mitzrayim. And some say that David HaMelech may have written it for Pesach. It's not clear, but it is the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. And strangely enough, for reasons that are not so clear, the order of the Makos in that capital are not the same order as the order of the Torah. So when you learn Tehillim Kufhei, you could be Ma'ayan in that particular problem. So at that point, we have a stira. I mean, is David HaMelech teaching us through Torah Shebal Peh that the order of the Torah is not the right order? So Rabbi Yehuda gave you this mnemonic so that you should remember that the order is this order and not the order in Sefer Tehillim. But of course you have to be fairly knowledgeable to need this mnemonic, because most people are not aware of the order in Sefer Tehillim, so they wouldn't have this problem, right? So this is an aid, right? An aid for a chacham already. When someone's a chacham, give him a way to remain a chacham.
What's the order of Tehillim?
I don't remember. If you look at Tehillim, Kufhei, it switches the order around for some of them. For some of them, it's not a totally. Is there a Tehillim? Is there a Tehillim? There's Tehillim. I can read you the order.
Isn't this the word of the Chumash?
Huh? Yeah, that's what he's telling you. In other words, he's giving you a mnemonic to remember the Chumash's order, so you shouldn't be led astray by the order in Tehillim. That's one interpretation. A second interpretation is that this is not Rav Yehuda's abbreviation. Rav Yehuda is telling you what was engraved on the Mateh of Moshe. That, you know, it's like loading a weapon, so to speak. The Mateh was given miraculous capacity. But the Mateh could have its capacity only for what it was authorized to do. So it was stamped or engraved on that Mateh that the Mateh can do these 10 things. So since there's not enough room to write out the 10 plagues, they were written out into an abbreviation. So Rabbi Yehuda's point was that HaKadosh Baruch Hu engraved in the Mateh these letters, and that gave the spiritual kayach to the Mateh to be able to do all of these miracles. Okay, that's a second interpretation. Now, a third mahalach, which then branches off into many, many variations, is that Rabbi Yehuda himself is dividing the Makos into three groups, because each group represented something unique and different. That's a mahalik that many Mefarshim have, but then they argue over what is the difference between group, right? You have group one, which represents a certain thing, certain pattern. Group two is a second pattern. Group three is a third pattern. And that's why he split them up, in order that you should understand a differential pattern. That's the mahalik in general. And then the Mefarshim have many, many different approaches what the pattern is. The Bala Turin points out that if you look in the Chumash at this particular question, is Paro warned, is Paro given a warning before the Makkah? Meaning, does Hashem say, or does Moshe say, let the Jewish people go or I will bring this plague on you? That's called Hasra'ah. Normally we know there's a general rule that we don't give people punishment, whether it's Misa or Malkus, unless they are given prior warning. So what's interesting is, the Bala Turim says, before the first Makkah, there is warning. Before the second Makkah, there is warning. Before Dan, before Tzivardeya, before Kinim, there is no warning. Now, before the fourth Makkah, there is warning. That's Orov. Before Dever, there was warning. Before Shechin, there is no warning. Then, before Hail, there is warning. Before Arbe, there is warning. Before Choshech, there is no warning. Now, Makkos Bechoros is separate, really. That's really not part of a group. That's the tenth one. Makkos Bechoros, in fact, did have a warning. But other than the very last Makkah, what you see is you see a consistent pattern. 1, 2, warning. 3, no warning. 4, 5, warning. 6, no warning. 7, 8, warning. 9, no warning. The Bala Turim says, this is reflective of a halacha that we have in Dinei Yisrael with respect to Malkus. This is what you might call, in modern terms, the habitual offender. That if I'm about to do an Avera for which I'm Chayav Malkus, I don't get Malkus unless I was warned. So if I was warned and did the Avera once, and then I was warned a second time and I did the Avera twice, and I got punished once and I got punished twice because of the warning, if I do the Avera a third time, I get punished without warning. That is the halacha, meaning I get punished without warning because I have already been warned twice and violated that warning twice. So the Bala Turim says, Hashem warns Paro once, he's over and gets punished. He warns Paro twice, he's over and gets punished. The third Makkah comes without punishment. But then, for reasons that aren't clear, Hashem starts the cycle over again. And that cycle goes through three cycles. And that is what Rav Yehuda is being merames, that there's a pattern of hasra, hasra, no hasra, 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 no hasra, 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 no hasra. Again, Makkos Bechoros in many ways is just a unique and different type of Makkah.
Yeah. What did you mean by the Atara for Chayav Misa?
Well, for Misa, of course, if you got killed, you can't really repeat. I mean, Hasra meaning they warn a person, if you do this Avera, you will be put to death. So if he did the Avera and he's put to death, he will not do it a second time.
Yeah, but I'm saying, they expect him to commit this some sort of Avera?
Well, they see a person who is about to do an Avera for which you get, they see him. We're not talking about, you don't give a person warning like a year ahead of time. When he's about to do the act, he is warned, better not do this or else. Uh-huh. Yeah, it has to be immediately before the sin. Okay. Now, the Malbim has a pshat. Can I see the Chumash there a second? And this is a famous Malbim. This is such a famous Malbim that even in the States, most sixth grade children know this Malbim. It's a very famous Haggadah Vort. And I'm a little ashamed that I don't understand it, but I have to tell it to you. I mean, I heard it in sixth grade also. But It's very good in the language. It fits the language beautifully, but I don't know what it means. And let me just read you the psukim, and then you can think about it, and maybe you can figure it out what it means. The Malbim says, you see from the language of the psukim that each group of makos were designed to teach a slightly different lesson about the nature of Hashem. Let me just find the wording here. Yeah, so we're dealing with Dam, right? The first group is Dam, Sephardeya, Kinim. So the phrase that Hashem uses for all three Makos is Bezos Teda Ki Ani Hashem. Through these first three Makos, you will know there is a God that has created heaven and earth. So the purpose of Datsach was Ani Hashem. I am the God that is the master of heaven and earth. That's why I can change the water into blood, etc. Now, when we get to the second level, which begins with plague number 4, Orev, we find a different lashon here. Just find it. Ani Hashem bekerev ha'aretz. Okay, in the first three makos, it's Ani Hashem. In the second three makos, Ani Hashem bekerev ha'aretz. So what the Malbim says is, kerev ha'aretz means I am Hashem that has direct supervision and providence over what happens in this earth. Because there are people who believe that God created heaven and earth, but He is not intimately involved. In other words, Hashem, Azav Hashem Azar, He doesn't look at what we do. So the second group of makos is Ani Hashem bekerev ha'aretz. Right? So the first is Metzios Hashem, to use the Malbim's language. The second is Hashgacha Paratis. And then we come to the third group. It's already borrowed. That already gets us into Parshas Bo. Borod is still in Vayiro. In seconds, it says Yadcha Lishmaya Pik Borod. Ki Lashem Ha'aretz. So the Rambam says Lashem Ha'aretz means that not only is God aware, but God will actively intervene. So I tell you what has bothered me about the Malbim. Again, the Malbim's diuk is gevaldik in the fact that the Torah uses three different phrases. Right, group one is Ani Hashem. Group two is Ani Hashem Bekerev Haaretz. And group three is what was the lesson in group three? Ki Lashem Haaretz. So the Malbim is 100% correct, but the only problem is I just don't understand. It seems that any Maka is showing Hashgacha Pratis of Hashem. I mean, how can you say the first Makos only show there's Hashem, and they don't show that Hashem is mashgiach over the Maisa b'nei Adam? Why is that? If Hashem is bringing Dam Sephardeya Kinim against the Mitzrayim because they're Meshavet Am Yisrael, that is Hashgacha Pratis on the behavior of people. So the problem is, and the Malbim doesn't fully, I'll go back and look, but if I remember, the Malbim does not fully explain why the first Makos only show you one thing and not the other, and the second Makos show you a second thing and the third show you a third thing.
Maybe just means the primary purpose.
Yeah, okay. I have to look at it again. As I say, every sixth grader knows this word. I mean, you will hear it from your kids at the Seder if you have kids old enough. And I just make believe I understand it.
The first three are like a natural overgrowth.
Yeah.
Of what, and it's, you don't necessarily see Hashem's hand in it.
Yeah.
Something strange. But whereas the following three, you actually see it's from somewhere else. It's not something.
Well, that is a good point. It's been pointed out that the first three Makos, well, it depends how you understand it. I mean, some people have a naturalistic bent. They say that it doesn't automatically mean an absolute supernatural thing. Blood, well, that's pretty close. But on the other hand, there are different coloring agents. Algae can color water to look like blood. Frogs, they can show up. Lice can show
created?
Up.
Huh? Didn't frogs get created?
Yeah, according to the Medrash, sure, there are a lot of miracles. By the way, do you know what the Abarbanel says? Interesting, right? The Abarbanel says, Sfardiyim does not mean frogs, it means crocodiles. That's a little more sinister, you know. Sometimes you look at frogs and you say, what's the big deal? I got frogs. I mean, frogs are harmless little creatures. But if you're talking about crocodiles all over the place, that's a little more frightening, you know. But okay. Now, the Netziv has a different mahalach about the groupings, which actually is very, very interesting. The Netziv points out that maybe the groupings are not based on what the Makos are designed to teach, but they're based on Paro's responses at different times. And he makes the following point. He says that Paro responded to group 1, 2, 3 in a different way than he responded to 4, 5, 6, and in a different way to which he responded to 7, 8, 9. 10, of course, he let us go. And here's the Netziv's deal. Again, here's what he says. Just find the language of the Psukim. After 1, 2, 3, the same phrase appears, Lo Shama Aleihem. He didn't listen to what Moshe and Aaron said. Meaning, nothing changed. Nothing changed after 1, nothing changed after 2, nothing changed after 3. There was not a single bit of movement. Now remember, this is before Hashem hardened Paro's heart. There was not a single bit of movement after 1, 2, 3. Now, after 4, 4 is already the wild animals. Arov is the first of the second group. We see a bit of a different language. Lo shilach es ha'am. So as opposed to lo shama aleihem, lo shilach es ha'am. So the Netziv, who had a very unusual chush to pick up, like a Rishon, to pick up these differences, is Paro began to make life a little easier for the Jewish people. He took away some of the suffering. He said, maybe I'll make it easier, they'll work 10 hours instead of 12 hours. But the one thing he didn't do is he didn't release them. So Lo Shilach Es Ha'am, the Netziv says, represents, after the fourth plague, there was what was called Hakolat Hashibut. There was a lessening of the servitude, but he didn't send them forward. And he still regarded them as Am. Am is said to be an inferior slave status. So after 4, it's Lo Shilach Es Ha'am. After 5, same thing. Lo Shilach Es Ha'am. It doesn't say Lo Shama Aleihem. Paro is listening at this point. But Lo Shilach Es Ha'am. Now, in 6, it says, Lo Shama Aleim. The Nesif has a little daichik with that. But he says, that just means, since there was no change from 5 to 6, it says, Lo Shama Aleim, but in reality, it's, Lo Shilach Esav. Now, we now come to the third group, starting with 7. And with 7, which is Bara, that's already the Hail, instead of saying, Lo Shilach Esav, it's Lo Shilach Es B'nei Yisrael. And for 7, 8, and 9, it says Lo Shilach Es B'nei Yisrael. What is the difference between Lo Shilach Es Ha'am and Lo Shilach Es B'nei Yisrael? It says B'nei Yisrael is a term of honor and distinction. So, Ha'am just means you're part of an undifferentiated, anonymous group. So Lo Shilach Es Ha'am actually meant they were still slaves, but there was Hakala Sashibat. Lo Shilach Es B'nei Yisrael actually means they were no longer slaves, but they couldn't leave. And the Netziv points out, he makes the Cheshbon, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah says the Jews actually stopped being slaves Rosh Hashanah. Do you remember the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah says one of the things that happens on Rosh Hashanah, we didn't leave Mitzrayim until Pesach, but on Rosh Hashanah we became free. The Netziv makes a cheshbon that Makas Barad occurred around Rosh Hashanah time. And therefore, we were no longer slaves. So he says, Rav Yehuda's point is, the three groups is, after 1, 2, 3, Lo Shilach Es Ha'am, nothing happened. We were exactly the same. After 4, and after 5, and after 6, we were still slaves, but progressively it was getting better. And after Makkah 7 and 8, we were no longer slaves at all. We were B'nai Yisrael. But Lo Shilach, he didn't let us go until, of course, Makkah's Bechoros. Okay? So the difference in the Netziv and the Malbim is both of them are looking at these as separate groupings. But the Malbim focuses on the lesson that Hashem wanted to convey through the Makkos. Ani Hashem. Ani Hashem Bekeref Haaretz. What was the third lesson? Ani Al Haaretz. And again, as I say, I don't fully understand it, but the Malbim has lashon in the pasuk that supports the three lessons of Metzias Hashem, Hashgacha Pratis, and that Hashem will get involved in the human Rishayim. And the Netziv looks at the groupings in terms of how it connects to Paro progressively letting us go. In fact, the Netziv says, I'll peep shot, this could explain the Dalid Lashinus of Geula. We know that we have 4 cups of wine because Hashem, in promising redemption, uses 4 terms of redemption, Votseisi, Vitzalti, Vigalti, Vilokachti. So the Netziv says the following. Votseisi is Hakolas Hashibut, which occurred only with 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, nothing happened. So Hotseisi is Hakala Sashibut. That's Lo Shilach Es Ha'am. Vihitzalti is the removal of all of the Avdus, but not being able to leave. That occurred with 7, 8, 9. Lo Shilach Es B'nei Yisrael. Vigo'alti is Yitzias Mitzrayim itself, which is after Makas Bechoros. And Lokachti is actually Matan Torah, which is not mentioned in here. Right? So the Netziv connects the three of the four Lashonos of Geula to the different stages here, right? Again, after 1, 2, and 3, nothing happened. 4, 5, 6, Hakolas Hashibut. 7, 8, 9, we're not Avodim at all, but we can't leave. Makas Bechoros, we could even leave at that point. Okay, that's how. Say again?
How
do the Lashonos correspond? Yeah. He says, Hotseisi is Hakolas Hashibut, which occurred in the second group. The first group, nothing happened. Hakolas Hashibut is in 4, 5, 6. Vihitzalti is the removal of Avdus Lagamri, which occurred in 7, 8, 9. But Vigo'alti is the actual Yitzias Mitzrayim, which occurred after Makas Bechoros, and V'lokachti Eschem Li Liam is Matan Torah, which is a post Yetzias Mitzrayim event, but that's a chelak of the goal. You see, by the way, but from that alone, you see that Matan Torah is one of the geulos. In other words, Matan Torah is a chelak of the geula, right? Where the fourth lashon of geula is Matan Torah, right? The fourth cup. Okay, so this is how the Netziv learns. Again, it fits.
That's why Sefer is on Pesach.
Yes, because it's all one thing. Because the Chavis without Torah, what does the Gemara say? The Korban Ha'imer that you bring on Pesach is barley, which is Maichel Behema. And the wheat that you bring on Shavuos is Machel Adam. Freedom without Torah is animal liberation. It is not human freedom. And therefore, Svira, the Sefer HaChinuch says, is to connect Pesach and Shavuos to make it one long Yom Tov. Right? That's exactly right. I think I mentioned. Some Rishonim even say, the Ramban says, that Svira Sa'imer is a long Chol HaMoed Pesach. He says it's Chol HaMoed, that Shavuos is the last day of Pesach, not Acharon Shel Pesach. Shavuos is the last day of Pesach itself. Okay, so now let's just do one other quickie section. Now the next section is from the Mechilta, and let me point out two things, that this is technically an optional insertion in the Haggadah, although every Haggadah has it. In the Haggadah of the Rambam, this does not appear. And the reason is actually fairly simple. Our chiyuv tonight, Pesach night, is to talk about Yetzias Mitzrayim. This talks about Kriyas Yamsuf. So technically, Kriyas Yamsuf is not part of the obligation, Pesach night. But nevertheless, it's a miracle that Hashem did. In many ways, it's a culmination of the redemption. So the Rambam was not gairis this. On the other hand, we have an edus from his son, his only son, I think his only child, Ravram ben Arambam, that his father said it, even though his father didn't make it officially part of the Haggadah, but his father said it as well. And we have three Tanoim, right? So you're learning a shtickle, right? It's like, you know, learning a shtickle medrash. We have three-way machlokes, Rav Yaisi Aglili, Rabbi Eliezer, who was actually Rabbi Akiva's Rebbe, and Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Eliezer is Rabbi Akiva's Rebbe. And the three-way machlokas is based on a common assumption. And the common assumption is that the makos are described in the Torah, although there's a big kasha here, as etzpa elokim, when the chartumim could not change, could not make lice from the dirt, they said it is the finger of Hashem. Now, you could have argued, al pi pshat, that, wait a second, they're not talking about all 10 makos being the finger of God. Maybe they mean only one maka. But Chazal understood that they are referring to the whole phenomenon of makos as the finger of God. Now, we know by Kriyas Yamsuf, it's described, Vayar Yisrael es hayad hagdola. The Jewish people saw the great hand of Hashem. So since a hand has five fingers, so Chazal understands that whatever number of plagues were on the Mitzrayim in Mitzrayim, the number of plagues in the Yom Suf are five times more. And all three Tanaim are going with that cheshbon of you multiply Mitzrayim by five. So based on that, Rav Yaisi Aglili is the simplest explanation. There are 10 makos in Mitzrayim, and they are called etzba elokim. So if Kriyas Yamsuf is yad, there must be 50. Now what are the 50? There actually are books that try to enumerate the 50, although they don't enumerate the 200 or the 250, but you can get a svarim that give you 50. The basic idea here is that Chazal tell us that when the Egyptians died in the Red Sea, they did not all die the same way. There was an extraordinary hashgacha pratis of midah keneged midah. That means exactly what they did to the Jewish person that they enslaved happened to them. So if they tortured him by, you know, breaking a finger, you know, they had that. So the 50 plagues, so to speak, where there were 50 different ways the Egyptians died, to correspond b'hashkacha pratis to mida keneged mida.
What does it mean by the word plague then? Because plague in my mind means something entirely different.
Yeah, so plague is understood to simply mean the divine manifestation of God's punishment, 50 punishments, so to speak. Okay. All right, so Reziat Lili, although we don't have a list, but it's a fairly straightforward point. Now, I'll ask you a kasha, though, and I don't have a teretz for this. I think it's a very strong kasha. This part of the Haggadah makes the claim that the 10 makos as a whole are only one finger. And therefore, Kriyas Yamsuf, which is the hand, is 50. Well, just a short while ago, the Haggadah made the claim that only one maka is the hand of God. Remember, it says, Hashem took us out biyad chazaka. And the interpretation of the first pshat was, that's dever. Dever alone is the yad chazaka. So you actually have a big contradiction in the Haggadah, that according to the early part of the Haggadah, a single plague in Mitzrayim is called the yad of Hashem, which would actually mean that the 10 makos are 10 hands. Right? And here, all 10 makos are only called an espa. Okay, that's a bit of a theory. Unless you're going to say that these Tanan are following the Dover Acher, that Yad Chazak is not going in Dover. No, but even though it's not going to help, because you're still going to have a problem. Because Yad Hashem is in the Torah itself describing Dever. It's not just the Drasha of Chazal. Dever is described, Hine Yad Hashem, Oye B'miknecha, Asher Basadeh. Okay. All right, putting that kasha aside, let's now look at the second view, which is Rabbi Yaisi Aglili. Oh, I'm sorry, not Rabbi Yaisi, Rabbi Eliezer. And here, he makes things more complicated, because although the Torah only says there are 10 makos, he now adds, each maka had 4 parts. Now, he doesn't tell you what those 4 parts are, but somehow there were 4 parts in the makos. How does he get this? He gets this from the Pasuk of Tehillim. This, by the way, this is the chapter of Tehillim that I mentioned before that has the makos in the wrong order. But look how it describes it. Yishalach bam. He sent the Egyptians charon apo, his fury. Evra again is anger. Zam, again, these are different words for anger. Tzara, adversity. Mishlachas malachei rayim, a delegation of angels of destruction. Now, pay attention here. How many words are used to describe, or how many? Charon apo, evra, zam, tzara, mishlachas malachei rayim. There are 5 terms here. He only starts counting from the second term. Evra is 1, Zam is 2, Tzara is 3, Mishlachas Malachei Rayim is 4. If that's so, every Makkah had 4, Mitzrayim is therefore 40, Yapsuf 200. But wait a second, he's not counting the term Charon Apo. Now, look at Rabbi Akiva, just to show you, they're very close, but Rabbi Akiva does count everything. It was 5. Shenemar, same pasuk. Yishalach bam charon apo, evra zam tzara, mishlachas malachei rayim. Charon apo achas, evra shtayim, zam shalosh, tzara arba, mishlachas malachei rayim chamesh. So, really, although we don't know, we don't have an enumeration here, so clearly, we don't know what the 4 is, we don't know what the 5 is. But clearly, they're both basing it on darshaning a pasuk in Tehillim. And it seems Rabbi Akiva is doing it the simplest way. There are 5 expressions of divine fury. Each makkah has 5. Why does Rabbi Eliezer not count the first one? Just as a matter of pshat. I mean, why is he counting? He's counting from later on in the pasuk. So the answer has to be that the way Rabbi Eliezer punctuates the pasuk is different. he learns it this way. He learns Charon Af is a kloliistic allusion. It is a general term for divine retribution. And in English, you would put a colon afterward, meaning Hashem sent onto the Mitzrayim the fury of his retribution, which consisted of A, B, C, D. In other words, Chairo Napo is not a component. It is that Rabbi Eliezer learns it is the general term which is followed by. In other words, Yishalach Bam Chairon Apo, which is 1, 2, 3, 4. So according to Rabbi Eliezer, if you were doing this with English punctuation, you would put a semicolon after Chairon Apo, and then you'd put a comma after Evra, a comma after Zam, a comma after Tzora, and a comma after, a comma after Tzora, right. Then the last one is Mishlachas Malachi Roim. According to Rabbi Akiva, there is no colon. It's five sequences. Chairon Apo and Evra are all part of a sequence. Okay. Now, 2 points. One is a thought from the Vilna Gaon, and the other is from Avadji Yosef. The Vilna Gaon says, why are we so interested in increasing the Makos? No, not just 10, but 40, and not just 40, but 50, and therefore, not only is the Yamsuf 50, but it's 200, 250. Fortunately, we don't have a pasuk to make it higher, but we're going to the highest bidder here. So the Vilna Gaon says, because Hashem promised us that if we keep the Torah, kol machala asher samti b'mitzrayim, every sickness and plague that I gave the Egyptians, I will not give you. So says the Vilna Gaon, the more we can give them, the less we can get. So we're better off. So we want to be marbe the makais, because then we're increasing what is called machala asher samti b'mitzrayim loy asim eilecha. This is what the Vilna Gaon says. Rabbi Avadja adds an interesting nikud. I think he gets it from somewhere, but I don't remember where he quotes it from. That we know that the four-letter name of Hashem, Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, represents the divine name of mercy, the divine name of Rachamim. Elokim, the five-letter name of Hashem, represents the Midas Adin. So the question becomes, do we look at the Makais as primarily an instrument of din and retribution against the Egyptians? Or do we look at the Makos as Hashem's love and mercy for Am Yisrael, to build them up? Now, there's people who look at the Jewish people and say, what a great nation you are that Hashem stands up for you. So Rabbi Eliezer, who says each Maka is four, that's connected to Shem Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, because the Makos are seen as primarily Rachamim. And Rabbi Akiva, that says five, looks at the Makos in terms of retribution and punishment to the Egyptians, and therefore they come from the five-letter name of Elohim, and it is the name of God that will dictate how many subcomponents there will be in the Makos. Okay? So this was a passage from the Mechilta that the Baal HaGadah incorporated, so you should remember not just Yitzias Mitzrayim, but Kriyas Yamsuf. So now, that is quite logical. Because once we've expanded the parameters of gratitude beyond the Exodus to encompass post-Exodus events, that gives us an excuse to now talk about everything that happened in the desert and coming to Eretz Yisrael. So Dayenu is automatically flowing from here. Because what you do is, see, you can't just look at isolated events and be grateful, but rather, Yitzias Mitzrayim is supposed to be mashrish in my heart, hakayas hatayv, for all of the chasdei Hashem. And then we get into Dayena, which again, an nigun everybody is familiar with, I'm sure. I will not sing it for you. But There are 15 Dayenus. 15. And it's been pointed out that there are 15 steps to the Beis HaMikdash. 15 Shir HaMalasas, 15 Tehillim, which are called Song of Ascents. And this really teaches us, and by the way, there are also 15 steps in the Seder, from Kadesh to Nirtza, are 15 steps, 15 Dayenus, 15 Shir HaMalasas, 15 Malos in the Beis HaMikdash. And the basic connection, of course, 15 is the name of Hashem Ka, Yud-Heh. And the basic lesson is, it is through Hakaras HaTov that one ascends levels of Ruchnius to become connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. A person who lives without Hakaras HaTov is a person that cannot be Davuk to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, the Dayenu needs to have a little bit of a translation. Dayenu means it would have been enough. So the truth of the matter is that all the Mefarshim say it doesn't really mean it would have been enough. I mean, what would it be? If Hashem would have taken out of Mitzrayim and wouldn't have given us anything else, that wouldn't have been enough. It means it would have been enough to be grateful for. It's not saying, in other words, don't interpret it to mean I don't need anything else. Chas v'shalom, that's not true. So Dayenu doesn't mean it would have been enough, but it means it would have been enough to be Mishabeach. Now, some of these are relatively straightforward. If Hashem would have taken us out of Mitzrayim and would not have destroyed their gods, okay, that'd be enough to be grateful for. But some of them do raise a serious problem. For example, I won't go over every one here, but look at this one. If he would have split for us the Yam, he would have split for us the Red Sea, V'lo heviranu besocho becharava, and we would not have been able to pass through in dry land. Meaning he split the Red Sea, we enter it, and then it closes on us. Dayenu, that would have been enough. It's a little schwer. Now you might say, maybe it's not so schwer. You could die happy, meaning to say, you saw the tremendous miracle of God, you could die now, that would be fine. I saw it. So some of Farshim learned a little al pi adrush, that lo heviranu besocho becharava does not mean he would have closed the water on us. That's not a dayenu. But it means it wouldn't have been dry, it would have been muddy. Now, the Medrash tells us that Hashem made the floor of the Yamsuf dry like a road. So that's an extra tova. You know, if we had to walk through the mud, it would still be dayenu, right? Something like that. Or another example of a famous kasha. It says, Ilu kervanu lifnei har Sinai. If he would have brought us to Har Sinai, to Mount Sinai, v'lo nasan lanu es haTorah, and we wouldn't have gotten the Torah. Dayenu. That would be enough to be grateful. Thank you, Hashem, for bringing me to Mount Sinai. Now there you also have a real kasha. In fact, this in some ways is more difficult than Kriyas Yamsuf, because Kriyas Yamsuf, even if you say that even had the waters closed on me and I drowned, it would have been worth it to experience a miracle. Okay, Beseder. But to come to Har Sinai without the Torah, what would have happened? What is there to be grateful for to come to Har Sinai without a Torah? So here, the many Mefarshim say that in preparation for Matan Torah, we became Ish Echad Uvalev Echad. So the Pasuk says, Vayichan Shem Yisrael Neged Ahor, we encamped by the mountain. And Vayichan is a Lashon Yachid. Camp, singular. What do Chazal say? We were like Ish Echad Uvalev Echad. Because we couldn't be Makabel the Torah until there was Achdus and unity. Well, let's imagine we achieved Achdus and unity. And then Hashem said, okay, I'm going to cancel Matan Torah now. So again, Avada is not Dayenu in the sense that it's enough. But Dayenu is, for Yidden to reach Achdus and love is so wonderful that even if it didn't culminate in anything beyond the Achdus itself, that would be an occasion to be Makir Tayyiv to HaKadosh Baruch. And that's the meaning. He brought us to Har Sinai where we became Ish Echad Uvalev Echad. That would be Dayenu as well. Now, just to enumerate the 15, because after we say each one would have been enough, we then say, but Hashem didn't just give us each one. He gave us everything. So what do we have? He took us out of Mitzrayim. He punished their gods. I'm sorry, he punished them. He destroyed their gods. He killed the firstborn. He gave us their money. He split the Red Sea. He brought us through a dry land. He drowned them. He took care of us in the Midbar 40 years. He gave us the man. He gave us the Shabbos. He brought us to Har Sinai. He gave us the Torah. He brought us to Eretz Yisrael. And he built for us, or he enabled us to build the Beis HaMikdash called Beis HaBechira. Why is the Beis HaMikdash called Beis HaBechira? Right, the Rambam's laws of the Beis HaMikdash are called Hilchos Beis HaBechira. This is based on the fact that when the Torah says, when you come to Eretz Yisrael, you will bring your korbanos in a designated place, it is called HaMakom Asher Yivchar Hashem. So Beis HaBechira is the place that God chose. HaMakom Asher Yivchar Hashem. So I'm going to make an anti-Zionist remark here, although I'm not really an anti-Zionist, and that is, it's important to look at the sequence. If you would have given us the Torah and not bring us to Eretz Yisrael, that would be Dayenu. But it doesn't say, if you brought us to Eretz Yisrael and not given us the Torah, that's not Dayenu. No, no, no. Eretz Yisrael without the Torah is Bechlal, not even considered to be a Tova. And that's why the Baal HaGadah says specifically, Baruch Hashem, Torah with Eretz Yisrael is a Gevaldika Bracha. But even if Chas V'Shalom, we didn't have Eretz Yisrael, we would be grateful for the gift of Torah. But the other way, you don't say it. You don't say, even if we wouldn't have Torah, we would have been grateful for Eretz Yisrael. That's not Shayach. Eretz Yisrael cannot exist Bechlal. Without Torah.
So okay. Mentioned the importance of Eretz Yisrael without the Beis HaMikdash, though, which is interesting.
Yes, that is true. That is true. If we would have had Eretz Yisrael even without a Beis HaMikdash, that would be something to be grateful for. Which is a very good point, that the holiness of Eretz Yisrael is something that exists even when there's no Beis HaMikdash. And indeed, that is why today there is the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. That even after the Churban and the Golas, the holiness of the land is still here. Yeah.
It can be dangerous without the Torah, Eretz Yisrael itself, because it can destroy its inhabitants.
That's right. Without the Torah, it's dangerous to live here. Right? The Ramban's, remember I mentioned the Ramban, that says a sin that is committed in Eretz Yisrael is worse than a sin that's done in Chutz Lars because you're in the palace of the king. So I don't know, it's not okay now, but many people have a minhag, it's brought down to read the Haggadah on Shabbos Haggadah, and they only read it up to here, right? That's why it always says, Ad Kan Omrim, all I gotta say, up to here is Shabbos Haggadah. Now, when you're at the Seder, it's already passed. But the Rabban Gamliel paragraph, which is the most important part, you don't do before the Seder because you can learn it, but you don't officially read it because you leave that for the Seder itself. So we'll leave that. You want to have a share tomorrow again? Okay, so we'll do tomorrow, same time tomorrow, and we'll do Rabban Gamliel. I think we'll be able to.
Was Wednesday the last year?
I don't know. We'll see how we do tomorrow. I'll have to call it by ear. Well, yeah. Thursday, there's no show. So Wednesday will not be after Wednesday. Right? Okay.
Thank you, Rob.
Yeah, good. Thank you.